Welcome to Think Twice on WYSO. I'm Dave Barber. Today I speak with Eric Mahoney, founder and programmer for the Yellow Springs Film Festival. We talk about this year's Minifest, which starts April the 17th, and listen to a talk session Eric had with writer and director Nelson George during last year's Minifest. Later in the program, I speak with Yemi Oyedaran. He's the director of King of the Mall, the story of King Records, a new film about the legendary Cincinnati record label. Eric, it's great to have you back on Think Twice. 2025 marks the third year for the Yellow Springs Film Festival and the second year for your Spring Minifest, which takes place April 17th and 18th. We should probably mention up front that your opening event on April 17th, featuring a talk session with director John Waters and a showing of his film Cecil B. DeMented at the Brightside, is sold out. Congratulations.
Oh, thanks very much. Yeah, it's such an honor to have John come to town. He was someone that we were in talks with to come to the festival last fall, but scheduling wasn't aligned. So, you know, I kind of circled back with his camp, knowing that we were going to do our springtime event, Minifest, again this year, and that was something that he was able to come out and attend. So, yeah, I mean, we're absolutely thrilled. Cecil B. DeMented is a film that I remember seeing in the theaters, you know, many, many years ago. And it's really lovely to celebrate the anniversary screening of that. And then obviously to have him come to Dayton, Ohio and talk about the film and engage with the community there. I think it's a great way for us to also kind of spread out into the neighboring communities where we are and produce some events that help spread the word about the Yellow Springs Film Festival as we're still very new and are trying to find our audience and, you know, just really engage with the broader arts community. So it's a great opportunity for us to both, you know, market the festival and to bring someone to town who is a very iconic filmmaker at this point and very legendary filmmaker. And, you know, very surprised and thrilled that it sold out within days of our announcement. So it's really great to see the support. And yeah, again, just very honored to have him come and be a part of the festival.
You feature new films, works in progress, and bring directors in to talk about their work. And you go back into filmmakers' careers and screen something they have created in the past. How do you go about making those decisions?
Well, I think that there's an importance in celebrating milestones with some of these films. You know, obviously a lot of filmmakers that I've grown up with and that are important to me have had, you know, decade-long career at this point. And so, you know, when we reach out to these people to come to the festival and discuss their life's work and revolve it around a film of theirs, it, you know, I usually look for something that really meant a lot to me out of their catalog. And then I think it's important to have some specificity around the programming. And so, you know, anniversary years, I think, are very nice and to kind of look back and celebrate, you know, 20 years, 30 years of a film and to kind of see the cultural impact of that work over time. And it's lovely also to have, you know, younger filmmakers attend. You know, that's partially why we are incorporating our day two of Minifest this year to have Ohio-based artists come and present their work. So I love having this sort of, you know, celebration of iconic works from the past, but also, you know, rounding that out with new current works too, to kind of give a full range of what's going on in film today. So yeah, it's just kind of like looking back and seeing what, you know, what resonated with me from someone in the past and seeing if there was a film that we could kind of celebrate and build a good conversation around.
We mentioned the Brightside event with John Waters is sold out. Before we move on to the events on the 18th, I'll mention that WYSO's Juliet Fromholt interviewed John Waters last week, and that interview is archived on our website. You can find it at wyso.org. Both of the events taking place on April 18th will be held at the Little Art Theater in Yellow Springs. Another dimension of the Yellow Springs Film Festival is the showcasing of short films.
Yeah, so I think the shorts program is something that our audiences have really gravitated towards in the past. So it's something that we want to kind of build and do more of. You know, it's also a way for us to kind of celebrate Ohio artists. That's something that's always been important to me, having put on small festivals that revolve around Ohio musicians and filmmakers in the past. Certainly, I've done documentaries about Ohio artists like Brainiac, and have done Dayton, Ohio centric works as well. So, you know, I always am looking for an opportunity to showcase Ohio artists, as they are very plentiful and very talented. And so, you know, it was a very good way for us to expand our program here with MiniFest and look to more local artists that are doing really interesting work. And some of those artists, you know, have left the state. There's a short film called Chasers that'll be in the program that just premiered at the Sundance Film Festival as well. So that's a big hitter in our program. But we'll have a very robust panel with the majority of the filmmakers from the shorts program on hand for our earlier matinee program that day and a conversation. I think that's very important to have these artists out to engage with the community and to answer questions and give a little bit more context to their work.
On the evening of the 18th, you're featuring an award-winning new film created by a filmmaker who lives in Dayton, Brittany Schein, who will be on hand to talk about it. Tell us about that film.
Yeah, Brittany is a massive talent. She just won Best U.S. Documentary Feature at the Sundance Film Festival a few months ago for her film Seeds, which was many, many years in the making. And it's a portrait of African-American farmers in the South, generations of African-American farmers in the South. And it's a beautiful film shot in very stunning black and white. Is just a very interesting meditation on farming, on cultural struggles, on the current state of agriculture in the United States. It's a really, really beautiful work. And so, again, quite honored to have that film, right off of its Sundance win. And I think we're the first kind of local entity to showcase that work and to have a conversation with Brittany, who is a Dayton, Ohio resident, is again, very meaningful and another way to kind of connect local-based artists into our program.
To recap the events on April the 18th at the Little Art Theater, at 5 p.m., it's the Eye on Ohio Shorts program, followed by a panel discussion with the filmmakers. At 8 p.m., it's the documentary film Seeds. Director Brittany Schein will be on hand to talk with Eric Mahoney. This festival is the result of a successful collaboration in the community. Talk a bit about the partners that helped this event happen.
Oh, thanks so much. Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely takes a village here. So, I'm very grateful to all of our donors and sponsors and to the Yellow Springs Community Foundation and our venues, Little Art and the Foundry and now the Bright Side, for hosting us and all of our really robust volunteer staff. It's very gratifying to see this thing kind of come to fruition and grow, and is very supported by the public. So I'm thrilled that we can add to the cultural landscape of Southwest Ohio, and hopefully branch out more even into the Midwest and nationally as an up and coming festival that people want to come to even from out of town. So it's a real honor for me to be able to kind of spearhead this initiative and bring these things to town. It's absolutely my pleasure.
That was Eric Mahoney, founder, executive director, and programmer for the Yellow Springs Film Festival. Again, the festival's MiniFest takes place April the 17th and 18th. You can see complete information at ysfilmfest.com. Before we listen to the edited interview with Nelson George, which was recorded at the Little Art Theater during last spring's MiniFest, I ask Eric how the connection was made with writer and director Nelson George.
So I've been a big fan of his work. He's just such a wealth of knowledge across so many different genres, from being a writer and a documentary filmmaker. You'll hear in the conversation, his wealth of knowledge across sports and music and culture is so substantial that I've just been such a huge fan of his. We were initially connected through a mutual friend. I had a podcast called the Contiki Podcast during the pandemic where I interviewed different artists, mainly filmmakers and musicians, about giving double feature film recommendations during the pandemic when we were all sort of, you know, quarantining and looking for things to do. So he was a guest on the podcast probably 5 years ago now. And that's how we were initially connected. And you know, last year during the MiniFest, I was looking at, again, different people that we could have come and showcase their work. And he was definitely someone that came to mind. So I reached out and he was interested in coming and was available. So we were really fortunate to have him. I came across his footage for A Great Day in Hip Hop when I was working in development for a film production company. And I remembered that he kind of had that in the works. And so that was one thing that I, you know, kind of offered as a potential screening opportunity for him. And he thought that was great. So we were able to kind of come and screen that film. And then he had another documentary in development about David Thompson, the NBA player, that he wanted to kind of discuss as well. So, you know, it all made perfect sense to me again to kind of bring him in and have this, you know, widened conversation about all of his interests and projects.
Here's that edited conversation with Eric Mahoney and Nelson George from last year's MiniFest. They discuss two works shown in progress, one about legendary basketball star David Thompson, the other about footage Nelson George captured around the taking of the 1998 Gordon Parks photo, A Great Day in Hip Hop. The title and the photo take inspiration from Art Kane's 1958 photo of jazz greats known as A Great Day in Harlem, which is where the conversation begins with Nelson George.
Well, there's a great photo. It's called A Great Day in Harlem that was shot in 58, and it was done by a photographer named Art Kane. And he organized about 60 of the greatest jazz musicians of the day. He was able somehow to get them to show up at like 10 o'clock in the morning, which most of them did not want to be there at 10 o'clock. And so that became an iconic photo. You've probably seen it in your barbershop, or you know, it's one of those photos that people have in their house. So cut to 40 years later, I guess.
Yeah.
There's hip hop magazine wars. There's the Source magazine, there's Vibe magazine, and they're dominating the market. That's when people still read magazines, right? Especially hip-hop. At one point, the Source was the biggest-selling newsstand magazine in the country. It was selling like crazy. XXL magazine starts up by a company called Harris Publications. Mm-hmm. They want to get in this market. Sheena Lester has an idea. Let's reshoot this photo, but do it with hip-hop artists as a way to sort of get the magazine out there and make our name. Easier said than done, right? How do you get artists to show up someplace that they don't not getting paid to be at? So they have to get a great photographer, some kind of attraction. She goes to the great Gordon Parks, who's one of those who don't know, one of the greatest living photographers, or was living photographers while alive. Also filmmaker, he did Shaft, he did other movies. And Gordon Parks turns it down. And then Gordon Parks turns it down again. And then finally she basically says, no one, this photo won't happen without, she basically begs him to come and do it. And eventually he gives in. She kind of plays to his ego enough mm-hmm. that he agrees to do it. And then organizing the event. But it was a mammoth job. Now, you should also talk about the fact that the day that they were shooting this, the organizers shoot it, it's a Tuesday. And in the record business back then, Tuesday was music day.
That's right. We were talking about this earlier. So in terms of this being a great day in hip-hop for this photograph, albums came out by Jay-Z, A Tribe Called Quest, Outkast, Brand Nubian, and...
Big Pun.
And Big Pun.
And we're missing somebody else. And it was Black Star. The Love Movement was the album by A Tribe that Jay Dilla worked on, right?
Yeah.
And you see maybe a little bit, we have more footage of like their street, remember Street Teams, anybody?
I was on Street Team.
Yeah. So the Street Team for A Tribe Called Quest is running around with the Love Movement.
Yeah, that's right.
Signs. And that's why Jay-Z isn't there. He's promoting his album. Public Enemy was out of town. The Tribe Called, you know, you see Tip in one shot. Mm-hmm. And obviously you saw Black Star in full effect, you know, and Mos Def company.
Can we talk about that for a second?
Sure.
Because that was one of the things that struck me, being able to see young artists at the time have that reverence for the past and to be able to pay homage to the past and to be in the same space as their heroes always is really heartwarming to me. And to see him actually really express that in a real way on camera was very palpable to me as a viewer.
Take this into consideration. We all agreed a couple of years ago that 1973 was the beginning of hip-hop, right? This is 25 years. Not to the month, but within the range, 25 years. So it's almost like the midpoint of hip-hop's journey. So it's along enough, there's a couple of generations, because basically what you're looking at is people like Flash, who were pioneers. Then you have Run, right, and that generation. Mo' D and those guys are there. And then you're going up to, I mean, I forgot that Dave from De La is so prominent in this footage.
Yeah.
You know, wow, he's died since I last watched this. So, you know, a lot of people have passed who were in this footage as well. Their shots of Common, and it's so funny because I realized that no one interviewed Common at that time because he wasn't as important. Like, you know, at the time, right? He was still a very young artist. Questlove says, I've only been in this, what, 6 years?
Yeah.
Think about that. And think about, like, he tells someone else, I'm not that articulate. You know, that's how far along, that's where we were. So I also should talk about why this footage is, because it's a crazy story. So what happened is that I heard about this photo shoot. I said, damn. At that time, I was starting to get more involved in filmmaking. I'd done some short films. I'd worked with Chris Rock on CB4 and a couple of other things, but I hadn't really directed. So I went to the guys from XXL and said, look, I ain't got no money, but I got cameras and I got cameramen. Let me shoot this and we'll be partners in this if we can sell it. Now, I got to remember, it's so hard to conceive where hip-hop is so ubiquitous now, right?
Yeah.
1998, if MTV, BET, or Video Music Box didn't buy your footage, there was no place to sell it. And I didn't want to, so we did a half-hour version of it, and we couldn't sell it. And then I got busy, and the producers got busy, and it all ended up in a box. And so for about 15 years, I didn't know where the footage was.
Really?
Yeah, because the guy closed down his office. He had a close office on Broadway. He moved into New Jersey. And so what happened is a book called Contact High that came out a few years ago. Nice photo book of hip-hop photography. And they were going to feature the Gordon Parks photo. Mm-hmm. So, like, you have any footage? And I'm like, oh, yeah, where is that? So my wife and I, who's my editor, went on a mad, we found the guy in New Jersey. He went diving. We still don't have, we have about 4 hours of footage. I know there's some elements that we never found. We still haven't found. So the goal, ultimately, is to make this into, I think there's enough footage to make a decent hour to maybe 90-minute film.
That would be amazing. I would love to see that.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I mean, there's so much stuff. So talking about transitions and gentrification, let's say, we talk about Harlem. The church that they're in no longer exists. It's being torn down to be made into a condo. Mm. That block, which look, you know, you can see there's like buildings with, you can see the roof through some of those shots, right? They're all sexed up now.
Sure.
It looks great.
Yep.
There's a couple of new condos on the block. And there's trees everywhere. So like that bare look that you see, we couldn't shoot the same photo now.
Right.
Because, so, which is progress, right? But so it's interesting to, when we finally get around to finishing and do a longer version, the transition in Harlem from the original photo to this photo to now is kind of going to be an amazing part of it, I think.
And was there a reason, I mean, I always assumed, since this is on 126th, that it's a block away from 125th, which is essentially the heart of that neighborhood. Is there a reason why that was originally the spot for the jazz photo and then this? Was there any sort of particular reason behind that, other than the proximity to just kind of the heart of the neighborhood?
It was just a block where he was able to make the deal.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I don't think there's any significance to the block before that. A lot of the jazz artists in the original photo lived around there. Similarly, a lot of the artists, you know, from uptown with it. But I mean, the thing about the photo, and I think it's contextually, again, it's 98. Tupac and Biggie both killed the previous 2 years. So throughout that day, so Shaquille O'Neal is there as a rapper, right? You see a shot of him in this footage. He had an album out.
He did. He did.
My biological didn't bother. That was a track. Truth. Yeah, that's actually a rhyme on the album. Luther Campbell's there. Mac 10 was there. There was a very, you saw one of the dudes from the Dog Pound was MC Shan. Corrupt. You know, people made an effort to be there because the narrative was East Coast, West Coast, rap wars. The narrative was rap stores as violence. So, again, looking at this history of where this footage is at, New York is probably no longer the number one thing, right, by 98. But the South is coming up, right? Mm-hmm. Guys from the Goody Mob are in that crowd. But they're still close enough that there's still reverence. Like, kids today don't have any clue about any of that, right? But it's still close enough that there's a connection that's only a generation or two removed from each other.
Well, that's what's really beautiful about this is because it was such a new art form still at that time. We're looking, 25 plus years that sort of the first generation was there.
Yeah.
And which you don't get that with other music genres these days. So that's really incredible to me. Let me ask you one thing. I've organized a bunch of music events in my life. I've played in bands. I've dealt with musicians.
It's already funny.
Yeah, that's not even the punchline.
Yeah, yeah.
But I've dealt with a lot of musicians. I have organized musicians to try and do little festivals or events. I can't imagine how one corrals that number of musicians and then their friends. And can you expand upon? I mean, it's absolutely addressed in this. But I mean, was at any point was it like this is not going to happen?
Well, here so everyone shows up. They want to shoot the photo at around midday, noonish one. Okay. Gordon Parks is there. He's looked at where the sun is. Right. That's a perfect time. So people start rolling around. Some people were there really early, surprised at 9:30 at the church. But by 1 o'clock, there's all of these MCs. There's breakdancers. And there's there's the publicists,
sure.
Managers,
sure.
Record company personnel, right. And hangers on.
Right, right, right.
So getting them from the church one block to the thing took 2 hours. So now when you
see... That's not bad.
No, but you gotta, when you see Mr. Parks, he's going over to everyone like, stand back.
Right.
If you feel the sun on your face, it's in the shot. Because now the sun is like this. And so it's coming like this. If you see the final photo, it's kind of like this. Run shows up, right? You see this incredible
applause. That's a great moment, too. That's a really great moment.
But guess what?
Yeah.
He's not in the photo. You couldn't see his face. He's just a shadow. So by not moving his hat, he's out of history, so to speak.
Wow. Wow.
The other story that will be in the final version is Lauryn Hill.
Yeah.
So everyone's there. Now it's 4:30-ish. It's getting, close. We're waiting for Lauryn Hill. A car comes down the street, and Rohan Marley's driving, who she's with at the time, right? And when that woman said, Sheena goes, thank everyone. She didn't mean to, but they thought it was the end. It wasn't the end. She wanted them to wait for Lauryn Hill. But they said, oh, it's over. So she drives up as everyone's walking off the thing.
Oh, man.
So there's some footage we have that I have to, it's somewhere like in a storage box of Kool Herc, the sort of originator of hip hop, with Lauryn Hill, but she's in the car. I don't think she ever got out of the car.
Wow.
So there's a lot of stories about the journey of the day. So, I would say the narrative of it is that's not in the film is how did this thing happen, which was kind of a, as you say, logistical nightmare. The other funny part is that Parks thought he'd get, 100 people. So he had a map for where he wanted, when you see him talking to people, he had a kind of map of where he wanted
more
people to
be. More similar to the jazz photo.
Yes.
Thing. Yeah.
But there's a lot of people in that photo who ain't rappers.
Right.
I was talking to a friend of mine today. His name's O'Neal McKnight. He's Andre Harrell's cousin, Andre Harrell, the late record executive. He's in the photo. There's a lot of people who snuck in. So that's why it's so massive. That wasn't like 300 rappers. It was 100 and their boys and girls.
Yeah.
It's been fun. And it's so weird now because we're so far removed from that moment. So now we're 5 or 6 generations removed from the original, maybe even more than that. And so I doubt that you could pull off, if you want to do this photo, what would it be like? You know, I mean, who would be in it? How could you organize it? I don't think the connectivity across the generations is the same.
Yeah.
You know, because I mean, I have people telling me that Jay-Z's old school. I'm like, you're kidding me. but if you're 21, he is. So in any event, it's really been amazing to revisit this, and also to see myself as a, you know, with half hair, and it's black. So it's also interesting to see that. So hopefully this will be expanded into, as soon as I find all the footage, into you know, some kind, and also interview some of the people. I've been to some events where we've shown this footage, and we've had people, some of the MCs, crying.
Yeah.
Both because they see themselves as younger people, and then also because, and I'm not joking, it was the Million Man March. It was, there was no beef, no anger. It was love. Guys are hugging each other. People are giving each other props and respect. So it was a magical day in that respect. It goes into every narrative you've heard about what hip hop was or is. So it was a special thing.
Well, I did want to touch upon that because it's in the film and you just brought it up, the Tupac and Biggie thing that had happened recently. Was there a sense among the crowd that this was a really healing event, that this was a time to kind of come together after some darkness and kind of heal as an artistic community? I mean, was that a sense that was
absolutely
throughout the day? Yeah,
I mean everyone. That's it's funny if you show this to distributors, say, where's the conflict? Well, the conflict is not within the film. It's the context in which the artists are there.
Yeah.
That they're there to say the narratives you have about who we are are wrong, and that we know a lot more about our culture than you do. And I think that's what, even this short film, you get that energy and you get the vibe and you get that connectivity. And then, you know, also the Gordon Parks of it was amazing because those of you who may or not know his whole history, he started Life Magazine, first black photographer at Life Magazine, when that was the dominant pictorial narrative of America. And he's got photographs from Harlem of a guy named Red Jackson. He's a young black gangster in Harlem in 1948. Who he could have been right in this crew of people. It was a different generation, but he's the same face, the same energy. And then he'd done Shaft, which was another fantastic pictorial version of Harlem. So having him was very special because it made that legacy. And I think that's the thing about hip hop at its best. You know, the sampling, which was very controversial for a long time, but the sampling links to generations. The thinking, you know, because you're using your grandfather or your father's records,
yeah,
or your mother's records, for that matter. And that, I don't know, again, you know, it's generational. I'm not sure that continuity is still there. But to them, Parks was very, very important. And he's one of the reasons a lot of people showed up.
Yeah, yeah, that's beautiful. Well, because you are so prolific and because you really kind of vacillate, it seems like, a lot between the sports world and the music world and the culture world, I'd love to talk a little bit about the project you're working on right now, about David Thompson, the NBA star. How did this kind of come on your radar, and how did you get to this project? I mean, he's such a fascinating athlete, and it's a really remarkable story. And talk about conflict. I mean, you know, whatever was lacking in this, you have it in that story. So how did this new project come on your radar?
Well, you know, I grew up in New York, so it was a basketball town. I did a book on basketball years ago, Elevating the Game, and so I've always been seeing basketball as an extension of, I call it BAA, the Black Athletic Aesthetic. I made that up. which essentially is that the improvisational nature of jazz, the ensemble nature of playing with a group, are very similar to music and basketball. That the rhythm of basketball is a rhythm of dancing and movement, right?
Oh, yeah.
So I've always been attracted to that. Even when I did the Willie Mays doc, we used a lot of musical montages in that to tell the story. Willie was a habitude of Harlem. People forget the Giants played in Harlem his first 5-6 years. And his introduction from Alabama was right to Harlem, which was crazy.
If you've not seen this film, by the way, you need to go see it or stream
HBO
it.
HBO Max, you got Max. Oh, excuse me, I'm old. Max, not HBO Max. Right.
No, it is a brilliant piece on him, and it's very well crafted.
Here's about David Thompson, those who don't know who he is. The number one, North Carolina State is playing in the Final Four in about 2 hours. He won the title in 1974 with that same team. He was the best player in college basketball. So he leads this team to the title. 2 years later, he's in the ABA. He goes up against Dr. J in the slam dunk competition. The first slam dunk competition was held in Denver in 1976. And it ends up being Dr. J versus David Thompson. And Thompson does comes underneath, does a reverse thing. Dr. J says, damn. And if you've ever seen this footage of Dr. J, and Michael Jordan stole this from Dr. J. He runs down the court, takes off from the free throw line, and dunks it. Dr. J invented that dunk. That's the dunk that beat David Thompson. Thompson then goes to the NBA because it's a merger, and the NBA is desperate to have David Thompson in the NBA. When Luka Doncic scored 70 points this year, they kept saying, well, who's, you know, that's quite not quite as good as David Thompson, who scored 73 points in a game. So when Luka came up, they started mentioning David. So David had this incredible career. He had the hops. He was 6'4", but he had a 44-inch vertical. Could handle, could shoot. The problem? Cocaine, which is a problem for a lot of people. And so David, by 78 or so, 73, he has the highest contract of any athlete in North America. Mm-hmm. He's one of the first really big money basketball players. But he's a country guy from North Carolina. He's in Denver, away from his family and friends. And as a lot of people who are old enough to remember, cocaine was not then seen as a totally addictive drug.
Right, right.
Right?
Right.
So he starts messing with it and, you know, slowly goes down. And the end of his career is it's almost like a joke. I'm not going to tell you what happened, but it seems crazy. He's at Studio 54 in 1984. He's with a bunch of teammates. He gets into a little argument with a guy at Studio 54. The guy pushes him down a flight of steps. He's done. So it's the film is going to be the journey of, to me, David is the missing link between the Jordan, Kobe, Vince Carter generation. And so it's a special connection. And he is, everyone knows Dr. J. Everyone knows, you know, obviously Jordan, et cetera. And even people have heard of Elgin Baylor and going backwards the other way, right? Yep. But David, partly because he's also shy, I think he never really, he didn't have the persona. He was a very quiet guy. Part of his issues, to some degree, with the money and fame was that he wasn't able to really articulate his feelings. And so the drug became a replacement for that. I did a long interview with him on the campus of North Carolina State. And what's so ironic for me going back is that night, we interviewed him on the court that he played on when he was a young player. But now the women's basketball team plays on. They're in the Final Four.
Wow, yeah.
North Carolina State. And we went and watched a game that night of the men's varsity. And they were okay. I had no idea that he'd be in the Final Four either. So it's all kind of gone full circle.
That's author and filmmaker Nelson George speaking with Yellow Springs Film Festival founder Eric Mahoney at last spring's Yellow Springs Film Festival Minifest. They discuss two works in progress, a forthcoming documentary on basketball star David Thompson, and A Great Day in Hip-Hop, which features material George captured around the making of the 1998 Gordon Parks photograph. A crowdfunding campaign for A Great Day in Hip-Hop is now underway. Check the Nelson George Mixtape Substack for more information. And for details on the Yellow Springs Film Festival Minifest, visit ysfilmfest.com. This is Think Twice on WYSO. After these messages, we discuss a new documentary film on Cincinnati's legendary King Records with director Yemi Oyedaran. 40 years ago, John Hartley Fox, a staff member and music host here at WYSO, created King of the Queen City, a multi-part radio documentary about the Cincinnati-based independent label King Records. After that radio series had received national distribution, his 2009 book, which took the same title, was published. Since then, other Cincinnati music historians, including Brian Powers and Randy McNutt, have also published books on King Records. A new documentary film, King of Them All, The Story of King Records, has emerged. Yemi Oyeleran, a drummer, a computer programmer by day turned documentary filmmaker and historian, has been forging together his film for the better part of the past decade. It premiered in Cincinnati this past winter and will be featured at a Florida Film Festival this month. I had a chance to speak with Yemi about the film and how it came together. Of all the famous independent record labels that shaped American popular music following World War II, the story of King Records might just be the most underappreciated, and its story the most ambitious to tell. How did you get involved in telling this story?
That's a good question. Thanks for having me on your show, Dave. I really appreciate it. What led me to King Records was my creative partner, JP Leong, and I were opening a new studio, and we were looking for ways to find what we called the Cincinnati sound. We were trying to figure out what was indicative of the Cincinnati music scene and trying to find ways to bring that into our recording studio. So I started going down a deep, dark hole of King Records, which was about about a mile away from where our studio was in Norwood. And from that experience, we learned a lot and started processing a lot. So we started making a lot of different types of recordings in our studio, kind of really inspired by King. We got pretty much all our instruments are pre-1970, 1980. I found a Hammond organ that I restored from 1951. Built my own Leslie out of old parts. Got a grand piano, a Baldwin grand piano from the 40s. You know, we drum sets from the 50s. We just got all these, started accumulating all these instruments because I really wanted to hone in on the King record sound. And in the process of doing that, I'd gathered so much information that it really became obvious that I needed to do something with it. So we started with a music series where we basically invited about 300 people. We gave them all headphones, and we put together a studio session in different spaces. So we used the Contemporary Arts Center in downtown Cincinnati, for example. And then we worked with the Comet Bluegrass All-Stars over in the north side part of Cincinnati, the north side neighborhood. And they're legendary. They've been doing this gig on Sunday nights for years. And we collaborated with them to put together a King Records concert where we did only King Records music. And out of all of this, we filmed and re-recorded. We ended up recording 44 tracks. My business partner, Nike, always remind me that we did 43 songs. And from that experience, we basically had this like record and this concert film to go with it. And I wanted to include some storytelling in it. And we were able to get some people to do some background and some interviews. And we started cutting it all together. And we started really, it was more disappointing than I expected. It didn't really cover the information that I had basically mounted it on in my head. I didn't really get out from a concert film project. So I wanted to go through a more formal documentary. And that began the process of making, so we accumulated more recording and more interviews rather. And we just kind of kept going through the pandemic, started getting more interviews, started getting a couple people to be interested, use some old connections to reach out to guys like Christian McBride, one of my favorite bass players, people like Vince Gill, and then started getting some people from James Brown's orbit, like Alan Leeds. And then we were able to eventually basically interview everybody who's written about King Records. And even in that process, you know, we made the film about five different ways. We first started with having a lot of voices of the people who were there from old interviews to having families, their family members speak, to having experts. And we kind of just settled on a path that we felt that would get the most amount of the story which is the version we have that we're releasing now. But it was, yeah, it was a long 9-year path to get to this point.
You have writers, musicians who performed on King Records, family members of some of the more famous musicians, insights related to King Records founder Sid Nathan, former employees, still photos, archival film and interviews with veterans of the Cincinnati music scene. How difficult was it to get your hands on all this material?
I'll start with your first question. How I began to amass a lot of the different materials was really hard. You know, in 2016, I just started by listening to as much of the music that I could find. So whether it's on streaming services or online or even just finding the records, you know, I'm fortunate enough to have Shake It Records here in Cincinnati with Darren Blaze. And Darren has been the keeper of the flame, one of the keepers of the flame in Cincinnati for a long time. And I just started just by listening to King Records. You know, I have an incredible collection of 45s. I didn't intend on having a collection of King Records 45s, but I do now. If, you know, there's a lot of 45s that never really got transferred to digital. I mean, King Records, they just recorded anybody and anything. So many famous people who got their start, you know, like Patti LaBelle did her first record with King Records when she was, I think, 13 or 14 years old. One really amazing resource was Brian Powers, who works at the Hamilton County Public Library. He's a reference librarian there. He has developed relationships with a lot of the King Record people who were King Records, the families of people who were at King Records. And he has an encyclopedic knowledge on King Records. And he was really helpful in finding materials, sharing materials that he had had. A lot of it, though, is just kind of the regular sleuthing. Going on the internet and searching state archives and state libraries. You know, for Little Willie John, I went through the extent of requesting from the state of Washington his death certificate, his images or pictures that they had still on file, anything that they had in file in the prison system, for example, to get kind of more information about his death. Over 9 years, if you know, I pretty much looked under every rock. You know, Little Willie John was kind of the one that I spent the most time on. There isn't any remaining footage of Little Willie John performing. It was kind of refreshing because you'd reach out to even some commercial archives and I would tell them that I'm looking for anything they had of Grandpa Jones or Cowboy Copas. And, you know, especially if it's some of the older guys who have had these archives for years and years and years, you just automatically see when their ears would perk up. Or you'd be able to hear it over the phone in my case, because nobody asks for these types of materials. You know, I think one guy told me that he hasn't heard anybody look for anything Cowboy Copas related since the 80s. You know, I'm naming a lot of these artists that are kind of lost to history, and there was just a lot of excitement from the people who had this stuff because they want this stuff to be out. They want this stuff to be used.
Someone's hand to lead me through the night. I need for someone's arms to hold and squeeze me tight. When the night begins and until it ends, I need your love so bad.
This story is so big, it may be best to focus on a few individual figures who shaped King Records. One of the most intriguing is Henry Glover. He's a black producer who played a key role in a company that was unique among independents in that it served both a white audience and a black audience. There are many who wonder why Glover is not only not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but also not in the Country Music Hall of Fame, while deserving to be in both. Tell us about Henry Glover.
Henry Glover He's from Arkansas. He went to music school, and then he finds his way to joining Lucky Millinder's band. He had been a trumpet player in Lucky's band, and then eventually an arranger, an orchestrator in the band, which back then is a lot more, I mean, in any kind of big band, that's a hard job and actually the most critical job. But, you know, he got to work with all of these artists in that process, like Bull Moose Jackson. And Lucky's band, you know, came in to do some sessions at King. These bands would work with different record labels all the time. So they come into King, and Sid really starts to take notice of Henry and Henry's skill. You know, Henry had this amazing ability to keep everything calm and keep the process flowing in the studio. And he had all these ways of taking really complex ideas and simplifying it that it can be used immediately by the artist. And Sid immediately wanted to hire him. But one thing that was different about Henry is that Sid had also given him company stock. So he had ownership in the company, which, if you really think about it, that's a revolutionary idea. It was rare to have a black musician in leadership, especially when you're working with country music artists and African-American artists. But then on top of that, when you give him equity in the company, a stake in the company, Sid was doing something that was, you know, very different, very revolutionary at the time. In later years, Henry really thought that he didn't get enough credit in his role in rock and roll. Especially with his work with the York Brothers. If you go back and you listen to the York Brothers, that's really where I think Henry felt that he had made the most contributions to rock and roll. And if you listen to it, he's right. There's a lot of experimentation that he did there that is kind of rockabilly, but maybe a little different from rockabilly. You know, genre is such a esoteric thing that it's hard to really figure out and pinpoint that this is that and that is this and this other thing. People spend all kinds of ways to argue this, that, and the other thing. But if you really kind of listen to his work with the York Brothers, you kind of start to see, and even the Delmore Brothers, but a lot of the brother groups, you start to see that Henry is stumbling on with experimenting this cross-pollination in a way that isn't really being done at that time period. He's experimenting. You know, Sid gave him free rein. You know, with the York Brothers, I think he did a version of 60 Minute Man that's awesome. With the Stanley Brothers, he did Finger Poppin' Time. Without Henry Glover allowing the artist to be the artist, we wouldn't have the American music that we have. You know, he really laid down the foundation in really critical points and critical times.
Another key figure in the King Records story is Ralph Bass. Bass was already a seasoned talent scout with independent record labels such as Black and White and Savoy when he was hired by Sid Nathan to oversee Federal Records, the side of the company which focused on rhythm and blues. At the outset, we mentioned the radio series King of the Queen City, produced here at WISO by John Hartley Fox, and his history of the label, which was published in 2009. John recently gifted WISO his original source interviews from the 1980s. In what is perhaps the most often told King Records story, here's Bass, who, unlike Henry Glover, is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, on how King landed its most famous artist, James Brown, and the reaction he got from his boss, Sid Nathan. The story begins in Macon, Georgia, where Bass is introduced to Brown by his then-manager, Cliff Brantley.
I don't know who James Brown was or who was the lead singer. I said, now I want to be sure this is the same group. Before I sign my name on there, I said, where can I hear them? He said, well, I got this big club. You come over tonight. Well, I came over to the club. The three of us went to the club, and they started to sing, and James got on the floor. Now, I did, and he must have seen an act named Big J. McNeely, who I recorded for Savoy. And Big J had an act in where he would get on his belly, and his back, rather, and he'd crawl all over the floor on his back, blowing his horn, the saxophone. And James must have seen this, because James got on the floor and did the same thing, crawling from table to table, the song that I heard on the dub, which was Please, Please, Please. And it was fantastic. I said, okay, that's it. Signed the contract, gave him his copy, and we went out of it. I said, I'll let you know. I have to bring him up. I didn't care about the other three sides, but those days we used to do a session consisting of four sides. It had to be done in 3 hours. But in Cincinnati, we had a what we call a house band. I used the same cats. So it didn't make any difference. They got paid by the side. I came in, got back to Cincinnati, called him up and said, you be in Cincinnati at a certain time, I'll put you up at a hotel and everything. Just you and the group. I don't know band. I had the man. There was a hotel in Cincinnati, the Mance Hotel, which was the black hotel those days in Cincinnati. Cincinnati was about as southern as Macon, Jones. It was a pretty segregated town. So they came up, we did the session, and I left right after the session. And I was in St. Louis when Henry Glover and Andy Gibson, Andy was an arranger, and Henry, of course, was the other producer. Henry, they came in and they were on their way to Hot Spring, Arkansas. He said to me, man, you better call the old man up. For what? I said, man, he told us when we found you that you were fired. I says, fired for what? What did I do this time? I don't know, you better call him, man. So I did. What are you on? What kind of everybody in those days thought I was on smoking pot. And I never even, I have a thing about drugs, and I never even smoked a joint in my whole life, because I've seen too many great, great musicians and talent wasted. Anyway, I said, what's wrong? Anyway, he said, you got to be on something, because how in the world could anybody in their right mind, that's how I used to talk, in their right mind, record the worst piece of I ever heard in my life. Sounds like someone stuttering on a record. All he says is one word. Oh, I said, you mean the Flames? Please, please, please. Yeah, took all my money, spent all that money bringing them up here. Give that man $200. I said, is that right? I said, tell you what, Sid. Put it out in Atlanta, Georgia. Because I had the dub with me. And they'd go crazy. They'd go out of their minds. I knew what I had. I'm going to put it out all over the country, not just Atlanta, to show you what a piece of is, he said. I said, okay. If it doesn't sell, don't fire me. I quit. I was so sure of this damn thing. Well, of course, the rest is history. He never discussed how great this record was and what a great job I had done. Because he could never do that. But I was in the studio, right? It was hitting like crazy. And we had the studio on the same floor in the back in the end of the building, and the trucks used to pull up and they used to get all their ship their records to load the trucks up for their branches and shipping records, and also their branch, their distributing branch was right there too, and there was about three or four booths that they used for playing records for their customers. Well, Sid Nathan came in. I was waiting. I had to do a session. I was waiting for somebody. I forgot. I was back by the studio. And Sid could hardly see. He was a bad eye, very bad eyesight. And he came in blustering with some other cat who evidently was not in the record business. He said, and I could hear him with his big, loud voice saying, you know, he said, you know why we're so successful here at King Records? Because we don't do things like anybody else. He said, I'm going to show you what I'm talking about. And he goes over the booth and he plays, please, please, please. I was getting my cookies.
He
would never tell me.
Please, please. Please, please.
I wrapped up my conversation with director Yemi Oyedaron. talking about where the project goes from here.
So, yeah, we're taking the film out on the road, as it were. Right now, I'm working to get it into film festivals. So we were also recipients of the PBS Open Call for Emerging Filmmakers, which was very, really instrumental in pushing our film forward. I really wanted to make it something that I would have found interesting, or somebody in my similar state, whether they're young, at whatever age. So we started all over again to kind of create something that was a better film. And we were encouraged by PBS to take it to some film festivals. So we're getting ready to show this at the Florida Film Festival. Then we also debuted the film locally in Cincinnati. We debuted it the day after Sid's passing, or 2 days after Sid's, the anniversary of Sid's passing. Cincinnati's kind of the background character. There's so many Cincinnati connections within the artists themselves and the label that we really wanted to feature scenes of Southwest Ohio, and it just felt fitting to debut it at the Over the Rhine Film Festival, which was a remarkable experience. They couldn't have been more gracious and kind in the process. We're kind of in the process of taking it around to seeing how it plays in other cities, and really looking forward to that experience and sharing this story on a much wider scale.
Special thanks to Yemi Oyedaran, director of King of the Mall, the story of King Records. You can learn more at ArtsWave on Facebook. And thanks to Yellow Springs Film Festival founder Eric Mahoney. This year's MiniFest takes place April 17th and 18th. Learn more at ysfilmfest.com. And stay tuned to Think Twice. We will continue to tell the stories of King Records through the 1980s interviews John Hartley Fox conducted at WYSO for King of the Queen City. For Think Twice on WYSO, I'm Dave Barber. Thanks for listening.